What force gail could not subdue through money war like ages is right now.
All right, this is a Peace and Justice program. My name is Chris, and you're listening to KZFR Chico, and we are listener-supported and community radio. We have underwriters, and I want to thank our underwriters at the beginning of the program. First off, Chico Performances, presenting Uncle Dad's Art Collective, performing the music from the Queen of Pop, Madonna. This concert is a tribute to one of the most influential female recording artists of all time and features a number of special guests at Laxon Auditorium, January 24th, 25th, and 26th. For information and tickets, visit chicoperformances.com. And by Sonia Airy, a local Allstate insurance agent. Sonia is concerned about the community and helps families understand their immediate and long-term needs and goals. Whether you're protecting your life, home, auto, boat, or motorcycle, Sonia Airy can help. Sonia can be reached by calling or texting 345-2351. And today we have a couple of very important guests. And I want to start off with Elliot Adams, and I will be calling him now while you listen to yet another wonderful Jim Malcolm cut, my favorite, from the CD called Sconeward. It's the song Neptune. Such a beautiful song. I'm sorry to cut it off. It's Jim Malcolm's birthday today, and he will be in Chico on February 2nd at the Arc Tower Pavilion, starting at 6:30. Tickets are available at the Arc Store in Pullen Cyclery. Hope to see you at Jim Malcolm's music. It's wonderful. I have on the line with me, I hope, Elliot Adams. He is a past president of Veterans for Peace. He's volunteered for the Army and served as a paratrooper in the infantry in Vietnam, Japan, Korea, and Alaska. He has served his local community in a variety of capacities, such as president of his school board, etc. He's transformed from being a soldier to being a nonviolent warrior, applying his intellect and body to building movements to create justice. He utilizes international and domestic law as a means to end our war culture. He is a nonviolence and social movement trainer and has served in that role for Fellowship of Reconciliation, School of America's Watch, Peacemakers of Shohari, Student Environmental Action Coalition, Veterans for Peace, War Resisters League, and currently works for the Meta Peace Team and is co-chair of Creating a Culture of Peace. Elliot's dedicated his life to stopping all war and building just communities of peace. This work has taken him all over the country and to the Mexican border. And he's recently been to the border, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. Hi, Elliot. Are you there?
I am here, Chris. It's wonderful to be with you.
Yeah, it's so great to hear you again. We know each other from BLR Force Base, from nonviolent direct action there to stop drone killings. And so I really appreciate you. As you know, you were on a delegation to learn more about what's happening at the border in December. Can you start with telling us who you went with and why you went?
So I went in with a variety of organizations. So I went specifically to do some peace team work for AFSC because they were having two demonstrations. But I also wanted to use the time to do some background for MetaPeace team, sort of exploratory work to see what it would take, what we would have to do to put a team down there, and whether there was a place for a team down on the border that would be effective. So, so those are basically the two. And, of course, obviously, I always am involved with Veterans for Peace. And down there, of course, we have the deported vets, the U.S. veterans who have been kicked out of the United States because even though they were served in the U.S. military, somehow or other the paperwork didn't get right. They don't have citizenship, so the ICE just deports them.
Yeah, that's one of the cruelest ironies, I think, of this whole thing, and they're doing such great work on the border now, so kind of the right people at the right time, I guess. But so you did a report for Veterans for Peace, and I wanted to go through the report because if you have the solution to this whole government shutdown thing, and maybe you should just say that up front, how could we end the shutdown?
Well, first of all, I want to be very clear. If you're in dealing with a shutdown, if you're in a grocery store and you see some kid beating his hands on the floor, yelling and screaming because he wants a candy bar, one thing you know, and that is he got a candy bar before by doing that. And we have to look at this shutdown the same way. It is terrible. We should end it. It's all bad. On the other hand, I don't think there's any reason to think that if the current president gets what he wants by having a shutdown, he will do it again and again and again, and it's just not a way you can run a government. So there's that aspect about the shutdown. There's also the aspect about the wall. So the wall doesn't make any sense. Should I spend time talking about why the wall doesn't make sense, Chris?
Go right ahead.
Okay, so first of all, Trump's argument is that killers, criminals, killers, drugs, and undocumented people. The fact of the matter is, most undocumented people do not come over the Mexican border. The fact of the matter is, most drugs do not come over the Mexican border, and the fact of the matter is that most killers come from within the United States, and that's where they start from. So. And if you wanted to bring anything, if for some reason you wanted to bring undocumented people or drugs across the border, then the way most of them happen is they come through the ports of entry. Like Sunset, I don't know what the actual numbers are right now because it's hard to keep track, but we're talking 70,000 cars a day. 25,000-30,000 people on foot. And it's obviously they can't check every single one of those cars completely. And the easiest way to get drugs and or people across is to bring them in, is to conceal them in vehicles and bring them. And then let's just say you didn't want to do that. There's always the tunnels. The drug enforcement, the guy in charge of tunnels for drug enforcement said, look, the reality is that border is like a piece of Swiss cheese. It's all tunnels. And because of the topography, there is no way we can check them. The only way we can find out about them is by if somebody informs us or for some reason there's some peculiar activity which helps us identify the presence. And when I say tunnels, I'm not talking about like a little ditch. These are tunnels with, forced air circulation, hydraulic lifts, tracks, like rail, long distance, and obviously, you could put so much drugs through a tunnel. It would be, I mean, the biggest problem is trucking it to the tunnel and away from the tunnel. So, and none of those do a wall address. They don't address the problem at all. And then you take the, and then the, another thing that's of significance is that the number of arrests, and we use the number of apprehensions on the border as a measure for how many people are actually coming across. So, a high percentage of the people holding people back, a high percentage of people coming across the wall, and I've seen this, are people who climb over the, because they can't apply for asylum the way they should be able to, which is just walk up to a port of entry and apply for asylum. They wind up climbing over the wall, getting trying to find a customs and border control officers that they can surrender to and apply for asylum. So a lot of the arrests would be solved also by speeding up the asylum process.
Yeah, that's what you said. If we had enough asylum judges, this could the problem could be ended in a matter of weeks.
Yeah, we have asylum officers at every port of entry in the country. That's every airport, every naval port, any place where you can come in the border. I don't know who knows how many there are of those places. There's got to be thousands of them, literally. If we took 1,000, I figure my calculation is if we just took 1,000 asylum officers and put them down on the Mexican border, we could clean up the backlog of asylum seekers in a week, 1 week.
Yeah.
Now, that wouldn't mean that they would have finished the process, but you would have gone through the initial sort, and everybody would know, okay, I have qualified or I haven't qualified, and that would. So let's talk a little. There are thousands of asylum seekers on the other side of the fence in Tijuana. Just in Tijuana. I don't even know how many camps there are, because it keeps changing and they have to move them and so forth and so on. But the truth is, the simple reality, if you look at the numbers, it's very clear. We are not at an all-time low for the number of asylum seekers approaching our border, but we're much lower than we often have been. So, you know, it's like, okay, so why aren't we processing fast enough? Now, by both international law and domestic law, you should be able to, an asylum seeker should be able to go to any border official, probably any official, say I'm seeking asylum and initiate the process and then get a credible threat hearing, which is a hearing saying, okay, yes, yeah, you probably are at, there's a credible belief that you are at personal, you know, human risk if you go back home. So you should be able to do that. But what they've done is they've started metering this process, slowing it down, only allowing a few to apply at a time. So they have this crazy process right now where you go to PetWest, and which is one of the border entry points, and you sign up on a list. And the list gives you a number, and that's the number, the group number that will be called, which will be when you can go for your hearing, but it will be weeks before you get to go for your hearing. So you arrive in Tijuana. You may speak the language, you may not, because many of them are speaking the Mayan language, which isn't generally spoken in Tijuana, the ones from Honduras anyway. You have to find out how to find PetWest. You have to find out that they don't assign numbers all day long. So you have to get there early in the morning and get started in order to get on the list. And the list is what gives you a number. And then now you are going to have to wait weeks before your number is called. Now, if your number is called and you aren't present at West waiting, then you go back to you have to start all over again. But it's complicated because there's no way to, first of all, there's no way to know what numbers are going to get called and aren't going to get called. Now, what has happened is some of the NGOs and civil societies have started, they listen to what numbers are called each day, they figure out which numbers are called each day, and how many are called, and from that try to project what ones will be called next when. But it's a crude process. And then you have the problem of trying to tell the asylum seekers that their numbers can be called, and that's complicated because not only do you have a language barrier, but you have all these different camps, and there's no way to know who's where, and that's partly just because the whole thing's disorganized and sort of evolving, and it's partly because there's a real resistance about... It's important to understand that many of the asylum seekers who are at the border of Mexico are actively being searched for by their oppressors. So you don't want to, like, publish big names, you don't want to publish photographs, it isn't clear. They often try to sort of keep quiet where the camps are. Now, this list, of course, is illegal by definition because you are not allowed, no nation's allowed to meter this process and slow it down, but it's ostensibly being done by the asylum seekers themselves. So it's sort of a self-regulation process, which they've done quite a bit of in the camps and stuff. But everybody believes that the Beta group, which is a Mexican group, actually is controlling it, and the Americans are controlling it through them, even though the whole thing's illegal. But if you look at the complications of getting across, there were 20 immigrants who were asylum seekers. Let me correct myself. Many of which were unaccompanied minors, some of which were accompanied minors, and it took 15 lawyers, three senators, and the media 15 hours to get the Border Patrol just to accept their asylum application.
Okay. That was something you saw when you were there?
No, that's not something I saw. That was something that was reported by ACLU.
Yeah, you say that they have to line up at 5 a.m., and for some of these people, it's a four-hour walk into town with carrying everything they have.
Yes, because, of course, part of the problem, if they don't so every time their number's called, they've got to bring everything they own, because if their number is called, they get on the van or the bus and get taken, and they have to have all the possessions with them. They've got to have all their papers and everything they own, because when they get processed, whatever direction they go, they can't go back to the camp. They get kicked out. They get accepted in the U.S. for asylum review, where they go to jail, but whatever it is, they got to have everything with them, so they got to bring everything, and they are going to have to come more than once, because when you're predicting, you predict a little early because you want to make sure people get there. So if you think that they're going to call four number groups today, you're going to tell five they're going to call in case they do call five, because it's never clear how many they're going to call, so that typically, people wind up having to go make the journey to try to get on the bus if their number is called multiple times through a strange city. It's just amazing, and you have to understand too. This whole thing is very, very disorganized because they just created it. For years and years and years and years, forever, there have been people seeking asylum and seeking immigration into the United States, and in bigger numbers than they are now. But it's only been recently that we've choked the process down and slowed it down so masses of people were accumulating on the other side. So this creates a problem that Mexico never had before. And the whole question of how you feed them, how you house them, is just beyond. I mean, we were in a camp that had no running water, period. There was no running water, no toilets, no nothing. And we took, like, toilet paper and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and they were delighted to get them because there was, they didn't have anything. It gives you sort of an element of how fundamental and basic their struggle for life is. in these camps, just hanging on for life, hoping to get, hoping that they can get an application for asylum before their pursuers catch them or the mafia catches them or whatever.
And you said in your notes here that as few as 20% may meet the test for asylum.
It may even be less than that. We don't know. So here's one of the complications, is it depends on the judges. So, for example, the New York City judges, asylum judges, approve 75% of the applications. The Atlanta, Georgia, approve about 5%.
Great.
So it all depends. So it's a very obviously it's a very judgmental part on the part of the judges.
Yeah.
But so nobody knows how many would be approved, and it's hard to tell even whether their credible threat will be approved. That's again very judgmental. Depends on the situation. So the Border Patrol say, oh well, yes. We're careful to make sure they have somebody who speaks their language, but as I mentioned, many of the Hondurans are Mayan, speak Mayan, the Mayan languages, mm-hmm. and the Border Patrol is talking to them in Spanish.
Right.
So there's this question about whether they're actually getting the information. The other thing is these are really disoriented people who have left their home and spent a month of walking through basically hostile territories to wind up in these very oppressive camps that are where they're just struggling for life, and don't know the technical legalities of the process of applying for asylum.
Right.
So they're likely to make a lot of mistakes.
So you mentioned people from Honduras, but who are the asylum seekers? I know that a lot of people have already heard this information, but who are they?
So actually, they're from all over the place. There's always this continuous track that come from all over the place, Haiti, from Africa, from all over the world, that go to Mexico to come in. But the bulk majority now is coming from what we call the Northern Triangle, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. And the reason they're coming from those three communities is because those three countries are extremely violent. Just to give you a sense of what it's like, Honduras is number one in the list of the number of intentional homicides per thousand in Latin America, and number one on the list of the intentional homicides per thousand world. Guatemala is number two on the list in Latin America, and number three or four in the world. And Guatemala is considerably further down. It's like almost like number 16 in the world for the number of homicides intentional homicides per capita. So you can understand it's extremely violent. The general sense I got on the border there was that the army and the gangs in Honduras are working very, very closely together, so close that the arms and the training that we provide the Honduran army winds up directly in the hands of the gangs. So if you are threatened by the gangs, the government's going to be no help, absolutely no help. And, of course, that's one of the keys for seeking asylum, is if you are coming from a place where the government either is unwilling or unable to give you protection. In the case of Honduras, it's almost by definition that they're not going to give you protection, since they are the government basically is the gangs.
Hmm. And how did
there was a woman, for example, yeah. who came out from Honduras. She was traveling with her husband, her 12-year-old son, her 13-year-old daughter, and her niece. She was traveling because she couldn't walk because she had a bullet in her spine from a stray gang bullet. Her sister had been murdered by the gangs, and they were afraid that her sister's daughter, her niece, who they were traveling with, was a target of the gangs because she was a sole witness of the murder of her mother. It's like, oh my God.
It's pretty terrible. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to ask you about what groups are there. You mentioned the deported veterans. These are U.S. veterans who have been deported, and they're doing work down there. But what other groups are on the ground in Tijuana?
So the deported vets, let me just talk with them a little bit.
Sure.
They're a fascinating group, and I just need to say a little bit about them. I mean, you take Hector or many of them have lived their entire life in the United States. They then joined the military. They served the military. They often have wives and families in the United States. And then suddenly ICE comes and deports them and winds up grabbing them, dumping them on the other side of the border. They don't speak the language. They don't have any family there. They don't know the area because they haven't lived in Mexico.
Right.
And then they have to struggle to try to have a life. And they have been the Unified Deported Vets. There's actually two groups of them, but have worked very hard at trying to catch their brothers as they get deported, because nobody says they're going to happen, and support them and get them going and get them up and a place to live and living. And this kind of identification of humanitarian needs has led them to do a very similar thing for the asylum seekers. They see them in great need. They identify the need, and they work to try to mitigate the fundamental life surviving parts of their life. Then there are a number of other groups, the new caravan or the new. Lost the term, but I've lost the term, their name now. But anyway, the New Sanctuary Caravan, they are trying to provide support for asylum seekers across the country. So they did a lot of work in New York City, and they developed a model where they not only get them across the border, but they try to get them into a community or into a family and a community where they can stay, because it may take years to finish their asylum claim. And so the New Sanctuary Caravan tries to find communities around the country that will accept asylum seekers and support them during the process. And then New Sanctuary Caravan also provides legal support for them during that process. They are also, on the other side, trying to prepare people for their credible threat hearing, so as they approach they try to help them sort out the issues so that they can present them in a way that will work, that the agents will understand that
okay.
They are a credible threat.
Okay, we're losing your volume a little bit, Elliot.
Okay. We're speaking, is that better?
Yeah, that is. We're speaking with Elliot Adams. He is in Veterans for Peace, and he's also involved with Meta Peace Team. And you said, Elliot, that if they pass this first test on the border, that sounds like threading a needle, basically, they're dumped out on the streets of San Diego with nothing but a form that's in English with a court appearance date. So this group, Sanctuary Caravan, is helping people in San Diego?
Yes. They're trying to catch them as they're thrown out, help them understand that piece of paper has a date, and that if they don't make the court hearing on that date, that they will be issued a deportation order. Many of these people just don't know. I mean, they're given this form that's got a date on them, and they don't know what it means.
Right. Where they're going. So, Elliot Adams, hold on the phone for me for just a minute. I have to just do a top-of-the-hour announcements, and then we'll be right back. We want to talk about volunteering, about going down there and how you can support the people that are doing the volunteering and support the asylum seekers. This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. It's noon, and I want to thank our underwriters, and in this case, it will be Grid Alternatives installing solar power in underserved communities at no cost to homeowners since 2011. Serving Chico and surrounding communities, GRID is the nation's largest nonprofit solar installer, providing benefits for both homeowners and the environment while training workers for the solar industry. Call 530-217-6115 or visit gridsolar.org to see if you qualify. And also Floral Native Nursery and Restoration, where the wild things grow. A California native nursery committed to the use of sustainable native plants for landscaping and restorative projects. For information about native plants and drought-tolerant landscape design, visit Floral Native Nursery and Restoration at 2511 Floral Avenue or call 892-2511 or find them at floralnativenursery.com. So my name is Chris. This is the Peace and Justice program. We're on every Friday from 11:30 to 1. And as I said, it's 12 o'clock straight up. And we are really graced to have Elliot Adams on the line with us. He is a past national president for Veterans for Peace. And he has committed his life to peace and justice and has recently been in on the Mexican border in Tijuana. And I wanted to talk about volunteers and volunteerism, but I want to ask you one more wall question before we move on. Mm-hmm. You also, with Meta Peace Team, have gone four different times to Palestine, and right now there's a huge focus on a wall. Talk to us about walls and justice and division, and I hope I don't totally lose you onto Palestine, but I think it's important.
Yes, and there are many sides to every issue. But I think that the reality is that the effectiveness of the wall in the West Bank is wrong. The argument is that the wall separated the Palestinians from Israel and therefore kept terrorism from happening in Israel. Now, there is somewhat of a time correlation between the reduction of suicide bombing in Israel and the wall, but what actually that's correlated with is before the wall, Hamas had made a strategic decision that they weren't going to use suicide bombing. So there isn't any evidence that there's a correlation. So the evidence that terrorism reduced is that there's less the evidence that the wall caused terrorism reduced is just a mistaken notion. The other thing too is most of the wall in Palestine is a barbed wire fence. Hmm. Now you can walk up to it and climb through it. So that the notion that that's stopping a terrorist, that somebody who's willing to commit a suicide bomb would be afraid to climb through a barbed wire fence is ridiculous. So it doesn't do it. Now that wall isn't about stopping terrorists. What it is about is taking land, and that's why the courts. Well, we may not want to get into that, but mm-hmm. So the reason the courts ruled that this wall in the West Bank is illegal is because it doesn't follow the border. But I think it does suggest that this notion there's other motives for walls than the stated notions, and the notions of security is not there. Right. We won't get greater security by building a wall. We will get greater security. I mean, we could do things. If you're worried about drugs, we could do things like take the $5 billion and put it into drug treatment in the United States and trying to help our nation get off of drugs, so there isn't the demand. Mm-hmm. Or we could put money into trying to give the migrants, people who are looking for a better income, putting money to make their countries more stable and a better way of funding. I mean, a better way of getting more jobs and a better way of having a living. Because the reason they're leaving is because they can't get a reasonable living. So this notion about walls, basically the justification of the wall on the Mexican border is the wall in between Israel and Palestine, and the arguments for that are absurd.
Right.
It's absurd.
Okay, so back to our own wall here in Tijuana. You wrote a little bit about volunteerism, what it's like to be in Tijuana, and can you talk a little bit about that,
sure.
About what it looked like on the ground in Tijuana?
Okay, so I think there's two things to think about. There's a lot of reasons why anybody and everybody would want to help. And there are a lot of different ways of helping. And it's important to understand that one of the ways, if you can't go there, one of the ways you can do is provide money so other people have money to do the work. So that's another part of the process. If you go there, it's very feasible. By splitting a hotel, I was spending $15 a night in the hotel. There are buses buses, and you can use Uber in Tijuana. In general, you can get by pretty well with English and not Spanish. So it's a very livable situation. And indeed, in general, I think it's good to stay in Tijuana rather than staying in San Diego, because one of the impacts of this whole talk about caravans, talk about the wall, is that it's radically reduced the tourism down there, so that the businesses are really hurting down there, so spending money down there makes sense. So it's very feasible. Some of the organizations which I worked with and watched were New Sanctuary Caravan, Enclave, the National Lawyers Guild, and Alate. All of them are doing very, very good work. They all work together a lot. I think there's more organizations working down there. But I think it's useful to check their website first and sign up just so they know you're coming. They don't really want you to show up for 2 days, because you can't do much in 2 days. They need people who can be there for a little while, a week or longer, mm-hmm. so you can learn the ropes and really become productive.
Yeah, there was a delegation from Nevada City that just went down. They spent most of their time, it looked like, preparing food, which is an important part of human existence, and I think they were quite happy to serve in that way. But what are some of the other positions that are needed?
Well, there's a lot of work to be done in the legal part. So there's things like observing what's happening on the border. There's things like looking for observing what's happening in the camps, because periodically the police come and raid them and illegally and throw people out. So there's that kind of work. There is, if you have Spanish, especially good Spanish, there's lots of work to do with the asylum seekers, looking for ways helping them learn how they apply for asylum, because you know as well as I do, when you're doing that kind of paperwork administrative process, you have to frame things the right way. The system isn't designed to help you frame them the right way. You have to frame them the right way. And if you're making a single wrong statement, it can be the end of your case, even if it doesn't change the facts on the ground.
Right.
So there's that kind of work. The National Lawyers Group is working on that. There's a number of groups that are working on that. Some of the groups, and it's hard for me to say because everything's changing so fast, because it's all evolving. And the groups are shifting what they're doing, but some of the groups want to train you in San Diego before you go across. But in general, I think if you arrive at Enclave at 10 o'clock, they'll bring you in and start training you to do the work.
Okay. So let me read from your report, because maybe you not have it in front of you, I think.
I don't have it in front of me.
Okay.
I moved to be sure I had a landline, and I don't have my computer in front of me because of that.
Well, it's okay. Let me just read some of this.
Please,
because
do.
It is important. So some of the groups that Elliot Adams has been talking about is Al Otro Lado, to the other side, Al Otro Lado. It's a not-for-profit group, and you can find out about their work. The email is volunteer at Al Otro Lado, and they also have a website, which is alotrolado.org. Enclave is spelled E-N-C-L-A-V-E. Caracol is the second part of the name. And so you need both of those words to find them. Enclave, Caracol. And so then the other one is the National Lawyers Guild. If you are an attorney or a law student or any kind of a paralegal, you would be much needed at the border, and you can look them up by just that. And then the other one that he stated that was important is sanctuarycaravan.org to find out about volunteers. And they work on both sides of the border, and they are looking for places for people to stay while they're going through their asylum processes. And I just wanted to add to that, in our local area, the most important group is NorCal Resist, at least to my knowledge. They are doing a lot of the work when asylum seekers end up just kicked off a bus in Sacramento without anything other than their paperwork. They are also working in the Yolo County Jail and just doing a lot of work with asylum seekers. So do check out NorCal Resist. Elliot, anything you want to add to that?
Well, we at Meta Peace Team, we're now sending a team down there 15th of February.
Oh, you are?
To Tijuana, yeah. So that will be doing both training and also classic peace team work, trying to de-escalate, defuse, and remove the violence from conflicts. So that's metapeaceteam.org, and obviously we're trying to fund that team. So you can join us by giving us some financial support to help put the team there.
Oh, that's really great. February 15th, and can just anybody go down, or do they have to have special characteristics?
Because we don't put people on teams unless we've trained them. We are doing an 8-hour training in San Diego, so our basic training for peace team work is an 8-hour basic, mm-hmm. And we are going to be doing one of those on the 16th in San Diego at the Nonviolence Resource Center, and we may try to do one of those also on the other side, because the deported vets who are also members of Veterans for Peace can't come across the border and do it up here, so we're looking to try to do a training down there for them. And once somebody's had the 8-hour basic training, then we can put them on. Then they can be on. Typically, they can be on a team. We have some other sorts, but they can't be on a team, one of our teams, until they've had at least that eight hour training.
Okay, so people can find out all they need at metapeaceteam.org for this this delegation on February 15th. Is that right?
Yep.
That is really exciting. I wanted to leave it open to you in the minutes that we have remaining to just anything that where there are gaps, where things that we did not discuss that you think are important to add.
Well, I think one of the things that happened is this Republican administration has concentrated our attention on the wall and the border rather than the issues. Mm-hmm. And the issues are, we are the United States of America. We care about other people. We want to help other people. We want to help people who are seeking asylum. They're not some kind of weird person. They're people who are in desperate need for protection. And if they qualify, we want to bring them in. We are a nation that is based on immigration. I look at it this way. My family was part of this country before it was a country. I cannot go to a single Revolutionary War monument without seeing members of my family on it. But I am an immigrant. Mm-hmm. We are all immigrants. And that's what our nation has been about. It's been about, you know, the great melting pot. That's what we are. And we've gotten ourselves stuck in this sort of xenophobic fear, close the door after I get in, kind of mentality, and I think we need to focus on how we give a legitimate process for people to come in and become U.S. citizens, become part of us. How we take the people who are in desperate need of protection and protect them, just the way the Statue of Liberty was given to us. So I think we need to sort of not let our minds get focused by other people. Now, there is a crisis. There is a created humanitarian crisis going on down there now. It doesn't need to be there. It was created. We've had lots of immigrants coming across. The number of immigrants is basically, or asylum seekers, is basically reduced. But now we've got masses of them on the other side because it serves some of our politicians' goals.
Yeah, I like the way you said that. It really rang for me. Can you, lastly, tell us about Veterans for Peace? I'd especially like to see what focus can be done to help deported veterans who don't really want to be back in Mexico because their homes are here. How do we get involved with those two groups?
So there are National Veterans for Peace is now trying to lift up the United deported veterans down there. I can't remember which congresswoman in California, because we're trying to get a deported vet who is not getting the care he was getting from the VA because they got him locked up. ICE has him locked up, and trying to get him out of jail. And he hasn't committed any crime. You know, they just figured it, found some loophole in his paperwork. So the deported vets are, I mean, it's really poignant. Their stories, it's just appalling. Just being ripped out of their country and thrown into some other country because of some piece of paperwork. It's a little tricky. I think what I would suggest, if you want to make donations to the United Deported Vets, that you go through the Veterans for Peace national website, because they're working on a shoestring, a literal shoestring, have almost no funds. They don't have an easy way to find them. I found them on the web, but it took me a little while, and there are some other groups of deported vets, which I don't recommend supporting. Mm-hmm. So I would suggest you go through Veterans of Peace. These guys are just trying to, you know, they're leaning up against each other. They're just trying to support each other and begin to get their feet in the ground and begin to get a life and begin to get a life in a foreign country and beginning to learn the language and beginning to get situated. Mm-hmm. But they have huge hearts, and that's why, even in their problems, they're busy trying to support the asylum seekers.
Well, I really
help.
Yes, that's really important. I have gone to Nogales for the last few years for School of the Americas Watch, and seen and met some of the veterans who've been deported, and the solidarity with Veterans for Peace, and really been impressed with the fact that in the military culture, you don't leave people behind. And I think that all U.S. veterans feel that way. And so it's not just people who align with nonviolence and peace and justice. It's all U.S. veterans who are probably appalled by that situation.
Yeah, and I will say that notion that you don't leave anybody behind, that's brand new and it's hogwash. the premise of war is you kill people. The premise of war is you put people at risk of being killed, maimed, and captured, and you don't risk the unit for a few people. That's just the basic premise of war. That's been created, that whole thing, we don't leave anybody behind, is pure nonsense. And it was created along with things like support the troops. Hey, you want to support the troops? Bring them home, for crying out loud. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be there. Mm-hmm. It goes along with the idea, they say, oh, so-and-so gave their life. They didn't give their life. Their life was stolen from them.
Mm-hmm. And, if I said to you, thank you for your service, what would you respond?
Yeah, I mean, I'm usually left speechless, because one thing I'm thinking is, if you are thanking me for what I did, I don't even want to be near you, because you are an evil person. Another thing that comes to my mind is you know, people said to me, oh, you know, I tell people, look, I owe the world reparations because I committed war crimes. And they say, oh, yeah, but you were young, you know, and it wasn't, you weren't responsible. The fact of the matter is we all are responsible for our acts, period. We are all responsible for what we do. Yes, I also recognize that every single American over the age of 21, older than me, owns a little piece of my war crimes because they were the ones that helped support me going and feeding me the lies about war. So going back to your question about thank you for your service, I also sort of feel like the people who are saying thank you for my service are either intentionally or through ignorance not recognizing their responsibility for war. There can't be war if the people don't support it. And if you know, silence is a voice of complicity. If you weren't opposing war, then you were supporting war. And if you're thanking me for my service, why aren't you saying, wait a minute, where did you fight and was that war justified? Because there has never been a war that's been justified yet.
Elliot Adams, I appreciate you and you know I do from
we've had a great times together trying to make the world more just.
I know. I just have to tell this little story, and I think I told it last time I had you as a guest, but Elliot did a sort of a die-in, and he was almost run over by a very large truck, and I completely freaked out and was just screaming for the truck to stop because I really sincerely thought you were about to be crushed to death and you would not move, and so I applaud your character.
Well, we have to, you know, the world's always putting challenges at us, and you know, something that I find myself saying now a lot for activists and people who are trying to create change is that if you're comfortable with your level of activism, it probably means you'll create no change. You're basically supporting, you're basically comfortable with the status quo. So what we need to do is everybody needs to, you don't have to do something weird like trying to challenge a truck. You have to do a little more than you're comfortable with. And if we do that, if everybody does that, we will radically change the world.
All right.
Because all change comes from the people.
All right. We'll leave it at that, and I want to thank you for being my guest on the Peace and Justice program today, Elliot Adams, and the Meta Peace team. I hope that some people listening will be interested. Meta is spelled M-E-T-A. So go for it, folks. Get down on
thank
that
you,
border.
Chris, and thank you for all the great work you do.
All right. Peace to you. Bye, Ann.
Bye.
Elliot. Sorry.
Peace.
All right. That was wonderful. We've got more Veterans for Peace coming up tonight. The Golden Rule crew member and Golden Rule project ambassador Zoe Bird will show the 25-minute documentary Making Waves, Rebirth of the Golden Rule, about four Quaker peace activists led by Navy veteran Albert Bigelow, who in 1958 tried to sail to the Marshall Islands to stop nuclear bomb tests. The boat sank in 2010 and was rebuilt in Humboldt Bay, California. The Golden Rule, a project of Veterans for Peace, is now sailing for a nuclear-free world and a peaceful, sustainable future. The Chico Film screening will be tonight, and it will be at 7:30, Chico Peace and Justice Center at 526 Broadway Street. It is sponsored by the Chico Friends Meeting and also the Chico Peace and Justice Center. There is a charge, but I don't believe anyone will be turned away if they cannot afford it. The Golden Rule Project is preparing for an epic voyage around the Pacific to Hawaii, the Marshall Islands, Guam, Okinawa, Korea, Japan, and more. This spring, 2019, they will cross to Hawaii and take about a month. The Pacific voyage will bring attention to the ongoing effects of nuclear bomb testing in the Pacific and to the environmental and human impacts of hundreds of military bases in the Pacific Islands. The team plans to be in Japan in August 2020 for the 75th anniversary of the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, then sail back to California in the spring and summer of 2021. With tensions so high between nuclear-armed nations, it is more important than ever to bring a message of peace into the Pacific. the current head of the current president of Veterans for Peace, says the possibility of nuclear war today is all too real. It is time to abolish nuclear weapons once and for all. The U.S. can show leadership by being the first nuclear power to sign the U.N. Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Come learn about what you can do to support the U.N. Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, and the Total Elimination of Nuclear Weapons. And hope that you will come out tonight for that. And then I of course, have to tell you that there's another thing, as this is Chico, it, as frequently happens, we have two important things on the same night. So I'm giving you a choice. You get to choose between the two. There is also the Roe versus Wade celebration from 7 to 9 at the Women's Club. There will be a singer-songwriter, spoken word poet, a band, a no-host bar, appetizers, and that starts at 7. So come on out tonight. It's a good night to be out and doing the work of peace, either standing up for women's rights to choose or standing up against nuclear annihilation. They're both important. Also, just a couple of things that are coming up is every Saturday from 12:30 to 1:30 at the corner of 3rd and Main, the Peace Vigil will be taking place at the corner of 3rd Street and Main Streets here in Chico. Bring your own sign or use one of ours. This is a tradition that goes back over 60 years now, standing up for peace. And it's one that we want to keep alive and keep peace in the minds of the people, since people are so distracted. There is also, I just want to mention, the Chico Cop Watch committee meeting is at January 30th at 6:30 p.m. at Blackbird Cafe on Park Avenue, and they are also offering a naloxone training, how to use nasal Narcan in order to reverse opiate overdose, and that will be February 8th, also at 6 p.m., and it is sponsored by the North Valley Harm Reduction Coalition. Beale Air Force Base protests continue every month, and you can go on our Facebook page. Occupy Beale Air Force Base is our page, and find out more or get hold of me if you can find me. And so I want to put on some music and go into our next segment, and I hope I can reach our guests. They are up in Canada, and I'm just hoping for the best in terms of the phone, but anyway, here we go. Have some music. Peace to you. This is a funny CD. It's called Extremists for Peace, Veterans for Peace. Pat Scanlon put together this CD. Here we go. That's not the right CD.
They call us all extremists because we're out here in the street. How unpatriotic, veterans for peace. They say we gotta watch them like never before, cause there's nothing more dangerous than veterans against war. They stand on every corner with cameras in their hand, taking film and snapping pictures of everything they can. Upload photos, write reports on everything they saw, protecting all our citizens from folks who broke no law. They've been watching us so long, they know us to our core. They know we're peaceful veterans who know the cost of war. Because we've seen the horrors and the price we always pay, they've gotta document everything we do and say. They call us all extremists, cause we're out here in the street. How unpatriotic, veterans for peace. They say we gotta watch them like never before, cause they're nothing more dangerous than veterans against war. War's a racket, Smedley said 80 years ago. 30 years of fighting, he once ran the show. A two-star major general who had something to say. When we go to war, a few profit, many pay. They call us all extremists, cause we're out here in the street. How unpatriotic, veterans for peace. They say we gotta watch them like never before, cause there's nothing more dangerous than veterans against war. They got Homeland Security, FBI and DIA, state and local police, don't forget the CIA. We are so important, a clear danger to the land. Can't let this love and peace thing get too far out of hand. They can listen anytime to anything we say. Eyes and ears are everywhere thanks to the NSA. Read our emails and our tweets, monitor our calls. Fourth Amendment, just be damn close, they're above the law. They call us all extremists, cause we're out here in the street. How unpatriotic, veterans for peace. They say we gotta watch them like never before, cause there's nothing more dangerous than veterans against war. Got their brick, play all their tricks, wasting all our dough. All those files and photos with nothing much to show. So we raise our voices here today to let them know it's time. Stop hassling the peace groups, go back to fighting crime. They call us all extremists, cause we're out here in the street. How unpatriotic, veterans for peace. They say we gotta watch them like never before, cause there's nothing more dangerous than veterans against war. Cause there's nothing more dangerous than veterans against war.
No time to cry.
Buffy St. Marie. Buffy St. Marie is a Canadian person, and that song that she wrote early in her career became famous and was sung by many people, and is very well known. But it comes from the roots of her land, her territory, and her roots. And I have on the line with me, I hope, Carla Tate. Carla is a member of the Gaseehu clan of the Wet'suwet'en First Nation. Her family has a long and deep connection to the land. She is also the director of services at the Unistaten Healing Center, which was constructed at the site of the protest camp in 2015 to offer a holistic and traditional healing to the community. And I want to welcome you, Carla Tate. It is an honor to have you on the program today on the Peace and Justice Show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, and we have a lot of ground to cover in a short time. So can you tell us about a little bit about your land in Canada and why it's different from other reserve lands or in the United States, places that Native American people own but and are have autonomy, some autonomy, but not complete? Your land is different in Canada, in British Columbia, than any other land. Can you tell us about yourselves?
Sure. So our community, or our nation, the Wet'suwet'en First Nation, we are we have a sovereign governance system that's been in place since time immemorial. It's led by our hereditary chiefs, who have ancient names that are passed down generation to generation. And through a grooming process, you know, from a very young age, our chiefs are educated on what it takes to be a leader and to become familiar with our laws and our Wet'suwet'en values and worldview. And, of course, at the center of that is our land, our territory. So through that process, they're groomed and they take on growing amounts of responsibility in our fief system, which is where we enact our laws, and on our territory in terms of stewarding over the land. So our head hereditary chiefs have pretty much the last say on what occurs within our hereditary or our traditional boundaries. And our land has been managed by house groups since time immemorial under that Anak-Miwiten, or our Wet'suwet'en law. So that's kind of the starting point, I guess I would say. With regard to our relationship with Canada and the land question, we had a landmark court case in 1997, so 22 years ago, called Dalgamuk. Dalgamuk versus the Crown, I believe. And in that case, the Supreme Court of Canada recognized that Wet'suwet'en hereditary leadership and our neighbors, the Gik'san, our neighboring nation, their hereditary leaders had never ceded their rights and title, their jurisdiction over our traditional territories here in British Columbia. So I know out to the east there had been many treaties coming westward, and because of the context and the history of colonization and this presumption that the Indian problem would be no more due to all of the illnesses and diseases and the residential school era and all of those other pieces that were working to, I guess, get rid of the Indian problem, BC was never treated apart from a very small section of the Northeast, the Treaty 8 territory. So the rest of BC was unceded land. So after that Dalgamuk court case, there was a really earnest push by the Canadian government to try to get modern treaties underway in BC. And some nations have worked out treaty agreements, but the Wet'suwet'en First Nation has not. We still vested all of our governance for our traditional territories with our hereditary system, our traditional law. And that's been operating up until we've had these recent infringements, pressure from industry and government-supported projects to try and access those territories without consent of our hereditary leadership. So that began with Enbridge about 8 years ago when Frida first occupied our territory with her home, building her home there. And in the subsequent years, you know, we've had amazing outpourings of support to build some structures there to support a healing center. And, you know, it's been more recently in the last 3 years that the Coastal Gas Link project, that liquefied natural gas project, there's been very persistent efforts of the company to come in and begin work on this project despite vocal opposition and our chief saying, you know, no to the project.
Right.
So, yeah.
I think most Americans don't realize that the huge fracking fields that are in northwestern British Columbia, as well as the tar sands in Alberta, and that it's all these pipelines are focused on going right through your land and to Kitimat, which is on an inlet in the coast of British Columbia, and they want to export to Asian markets in order to make enormous profits. But these enormous profits are also linked with kind of the death knell of climate change, because once all of that fossil fuel is dug up and it's emitting all that it has with carbon, that it could, there'll be no turning back. And so the Canadian government in two ways is violating things that they think are important. They talk about reconciliation with Native people, but they also talk about climate change reduction, and they're doing this. So can you talk a little bit about the strain, the pressures you're under, and what it means?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, I always return to our governance system because that's really the grounds or the rooting of our struggle. You know, we, as Indigenous people who've been sovereign, who've managed and stewarded our lands, I would say successfully for millennia, you know, to the point that we still have territories that are vital today. You know, there was 22,000 square kilometers identified in the Delgamuukw trial that were, you know, unceded territories. And of course, a lot of those have been encroached on by municipalities and other settlers here in Canada. So we're holding on to a remaining 10% of that land. Mm. And it also holds the headwaters, the spawning estuaries for two major river systems here in the north that bring salmon to sustenance fishers, nations, and also, you know, sports fishers, the rest of the Canadians who love, you know, the sport of fishing and the amazing healthy food and that, like, more direct connection to the life cycle, I guess, and our food sources. So it's, I guess from that vantage point, you know, we've always had sustainability written into our laws as Wet'suwet'en people. We recognize that we are borrowing this territory from future generations, and it is the responsibility of our leaders, of the membership, to use those lands in a sustainable manner so that there is something for the future. So, like, one example is that, you know, decisions made on any given tract of territory can't negatively impact our neighbors. So we saw that with fishing harvest historically, that, you know, no one was able to do like 100% kind of extraction from the fishing runs. You know, they had, their technology was such that it allowed enough of the runs through to ensure future sustainability, and that, you know, there was enough for neighbors downstream. So we only took what was needed. So, you know, I think that's the same lens that we consider these projects with. You know, we are like any other nation, and as a result of still reeling from current and past experiences with colonization that have caused a huge discrepancy in the social determinants of health among our reserve communities, we desperately need economic opportunities. But at the same time, we can't turn our backs.
Carla? Are you still there, I hope? I may have lost her. I'm hoping I'm not, so I'm just going to wait for a moment. You have been listening to Carla Tate. She is a member of the Unist'ot'en, and their land along the Maurice River has been...
Hi.
There you are. Oh, thank you. I'm so glad you're back.
I inadvertently hit the mute button.
I notice your absence.
Yeah, I'm not too sure where I trailed off or muted.
Well, you were just talking about the sustainability of what you're doing, and in light of colonization, how difficult it has been to sustain yourselves, and you've got a lot of balls up in the air. I know there's a lot of money that's been given out by the oil and gas industry, $620 million in contracts for First Nations businesses and contracted along the proposed pipeline route. And your hereditary chief's decision to not cooperate, to not go along, and the blockade, which is held until January, has been a model, I think, for those of us who work on peace and justice issues around the world, and I've been supporting you for since 2012 myself. I just really appreciate your work, and I was wondering if you could talk about where are you at now with I think there's been an injunction against you. Now you have all these legal battles that you have to wage. Can you tell us about what's happening right now?
Sure. Yeah. So all of the confrontation, I think, has come to a head. In December, there was an application by CGL for an injunction. So they were seeking the court's support with enforcing their access to our territories. So we did respond to that. Frida had the interlocutory or the permanent injunction date delayed or extended, so that her responses are due by the end of this month. And in the meantime, because of the interim injunctions, and I think injunction law is, from my understanding, pretty cut and dried. It's often the pathway that industries use to overstep Aboriginal rights and title. And so the permitting and like the provincial permitting that was issued is used as the justification for that infringement on our rights to our territory. And so proper consultation and consent has been sidestepped with the true authorities on our territory by reaching out to band councils and others peripheral to the route, but not on the impacted lands. So we are just now at the point where Frida's been personally named in the civil suit, and also the injunction in place. So it's at enormous legal costs that we've got to battle this in court to a certain degree. And depending on the outcome here, you know, we're certainly going to hold our ground and try to protect our sovereignty by taking any next steps that are necessary legally, but also on the ground. So, you know, we aren't seeing this as defeat. Unfortunately, with the show of militarized police force against our unarmed women and even elders at the Gidimden checkpoint, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that.
I am,
the Gidimden. Okay.
Tell our listeners.
The Gidimden had stepped up to assist the Unist'ot'en, who we've had this stand for 8 years through Frida's tireless work to keep industry out, keep these fossil fuel projects out of our last bit of remaining intact, viable territory for our vision for that land, which, of course, is land-based healing for our community members and for other guests and visitors. And so the Gidimden stepped up when they heard about this injunction and decided to start demonstrating and upholding their responsibility over their territory, and had established a checkpoint. which was forcefully removed by the militarized 23 units of technical operative police, I guess. So that show of force and, you know, the fact that the police had set up an exclusion zone that kept media and other public observers to keep them accountable about 15 or so kilometers away, our chiefs were concerned about the safety of our Unas.N members after the takedown of Gidim Den, that they, and also in light of the fact that a Wet'suwet'en matriarch's funeral was occurring the same day, they were going to storm our checkpoint. They decided to work out a temporary agreement with the RCMP that would allow them to remove the checkpoint for the safety of our members. So very much under duress, allowed for them to uphold the interim injunction while we regroup and figure out how to challenge this legally and otherwise to protect our territory. We're still adamantly opposed to the pipeline and don't plan to allow it to proceed. So we're exploring all options in terms of challenging the permits, in terms of legally challenging. So we are at a huge disadvantage, though, against industry and the government.
I feel it in your voice. I feel the pressure of it, and I'm awfully, terribly sorry for the loss of your matriarch there, too. And you have had a lot of support already, the people in the Canadian music industry, many around the world. And I was wondering if you could tell us about how to support you, how to add our voices to the people all over the world who want to help. And it sounds like financial help with the legal is what's needed right now.
Absolutely. So there's a lot of different ways to help. I think for folks who have the means, we've definitely welcomed all funds raised towards legal fees and other ways to support the camp. The other piece is, you know, we've been having our healing center operating with various camps for different target groups and have a few that were struggling with addictions currently living there now. So we're also wanting to still be a safe place for those individuals and continue having that opportunity to be on the land. So I think support to the Unas.N camp is incredibly appreciated. Also to, of course, the legal fund, just knowing that we've got some immense odds and resources stacked against us by the Canadian state and industry. The other ways that folks can support is definitely to take action. You know, we've asked people to, we saw a worldwide demonstration after that Gidim Den checkpoint was taken down. And, you know, it's definitely uplifting. And I think it's impactful for Canadian officials that are coming into an election cycle, like to know that there's worldwide pressures that are questioning their conduct and the discrepancy between their endorsed values and commitments forward for the environment and, you know, their adoption of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. There's ways that we can turn some attention to Canada and ask them to be accountable to these commitments they've made. We have also asked folks to sign various pledges in support to educate others, you know, use your knowledge about this situation to influence others around you and help people understand the cause and the injustice of it. Statements of support. I would just say, you know, definitely vocalizing support, raising funds, actions. Those are all amazing ways that, you know, supporters can help us. And I believe there's been a Wet'suwet'en supporter toolkit published with some really good options outlined and then our GoFundMe pages off of our Unistaten camp website as well are great ways to reach out.
Let me just stop you and spell this for people, because it's you don't have to use the apostrophes the way it is correctly broken up, but if you just put in WETSUWETEN and toolkit, you can find out all the different ways. You can find out why this is happening, what is happening, and ways that you can help in many, many ways, and you can share it with others, and it's extremely important. And also on Facebook, I'm just going to, excuse me, Carla, for giving this spelling. I know it's probably disrespectful, but...
No worries. I'd like for people to be able to find it.
Unistoten is UNISTOTEN, okay? And that would be a great help, I think, if everyone does. And in Chico, which is a little town in California that we're in, we have done solidarity demonstrations in the past, and I hope that people will be involved with groups like Chico 350 that are trying to stop oil and gas companies, like this Coastal Gas Link that is going to be bringing the frack gas through their land if they're able to. And just following what's going on there, I mean, culturally, part of the healing I saw today that almost brought me to tears was about a young man who was standing out there, and they had bulldozed a trap line, and he was just totally despondent. And I think just to understand the importance of some of the traditional healing work that you, Carla Tate, are trying to do with people there, I think is extremely important.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Is there any last minute thing that you thought of while I was speaking that you would like to say for our closing?
No, just that, you know, for me, I think in light of all of the ways we've witnessed, you know, that true reconciliation and a way forward with the government of Canada have been, you know, trampled, right, by these recent actions. Like,
yes.
Through our experience, you know, we know reconciliation is not done at gunpoint. So I would just say it's been really heartening to see the outpouring of support, and it makes a huge difference for us. Like, we've had a number of non-Indigenous, non-Wet'suwet'en supporters come and assist at the camp, give their time, like take time out of their own lives to make sacrifices that truly, person by person, are working towards what true reconciliation is. So I would just want to end on a bit of a positive note. I think through all of this experience, you know, we're familiar with the experience of lived colonization, and I think it's important for us to raise that awareness for folks that it's not something that happened in the past. It's still happening, but we can either be complicit in it, or we can take actions to correct it and ensure a better future for our children and our future.
I want to thank you for your time today, Carla Tate. I want to wish you the best, both you personally and for all the Wet'suwet'en people there in what is now called British Columbia, and that you will be successful in stopping the Canadian government and the oil and gas industry who are trying to usurp your rights. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. Peace to you.
Thank you for having us.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Okay, so sobering information, I think, and we didn't even go into all of the information about the numerous pipelines they are trying to bring across their land. It is not just one pipeline. They were able to stop the Enbridge pipeline, but now there's two more proposed and more on the horizon. So if they can get away with that, they will. So anyway, let's go out with a little bit of music, and then we'll go to the community calendar. And I wish you the very, very best, and I hope you will engage as best you can. Oops, no time for music. Let's go straight. Playing Dead is coming straight up. You've been listening to the Peace and Justice program, and I'm getting out of here late, I just realized. I want to thank Monca, the Museum of Northern California Art. Monca presenting world-renowned magician Peter Samuelson on Sunday, January 27th at 7 p.m. This is Peter's second performance at Monca. The first one left the audience amazed, stunned, and laughing. For tickets to this amazing evening and information about the museum, including event rentals and exhibits, visit monca.org, M-O-N-C-A, or call 487-7272 and buy Live Life Juice Company, providing fresh, locally made organic cold pressed juices and elixirs, also serving vegan and gluten-free organic prepared food and soft serve. Open weekdays from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m., weekends 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. More information at livelifejuiceco.com, on Facebook and Instagram, and at 566-3346. Now delivering, Live Life Juice Company says drink to your health. And let's go ahead and hear that community calendar right now. Find out what's going on.
This is the KZFR Events Calendar. I'm Ricky Anderson. Thanks for listening to 90.1 KZFR. Friday, February 1st, a campfire benefit with Joe Craven, Alex Degrassi, and Lori Lewis with Nina Gerber at the Chico Women's Club. Tickets on sale right now at the usual outlets. And coming Friday, February 8th, our rescheduled comedy show with Will Durst and Hank Duke will be at the Chico Women's Club. If you got tickets through Pledge Drive or in advance, for the postponed show, this is when it's happening. It's Friday, February 8th. Will Durst and Hank Duke at the Chico Women's Club. Tickets on sale right now at the usual outlets. Friday, February 22nd, it's Alex and Ben Morrison from the Brothers Comatose with special guest Scott Pemberton at the Chico Women's Club. This is a campfire benefit. Tickets on sale now at the usual outlets. Tea Sisters are coming back to town, playing at the Chico Women's Club on Thursday, March 7th. And just announced, Friday, March 22nd, it's Steve Pultz at the Chico Women's Club. And Sunday, March 24th, Robbie Folks at the Chico Women's Club. Tickets on sale soon for both of those shows.